The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we are reading from the November 1st, 2013 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories, and how they were covered. The panicky race to fix Obamacare's website. What happened? The Obama administration this week raced to fix the technical problems that have crippled its new federal health care website and frustrated Americans who've tried to shop for the policies on the insurance exchanges. President Obama said he had hired some of the best IT talent in the country to work around the clock on healthcare.gov, which processes enrollments for insurance in 36 states under the Affordable Care Act. No one is madder about the website than I am, he said, which means it's going to get fixed. But specialists working on the project warned that repairs may take weeks, since about 5 million of the 500 million lines of code in the incredibly complex software may need to be rewritten. So efforts to fix the site may run into the hard deadline set by the Affordable Care Act. People without insurance have until December 15th to sign up for coverage that starts January 1st, and until March 31st to get coverage in 2014 and avoid a fine. The Washington Post reported that an internal test of healthcare.gov in September resulted in a crash, even though just a few hundred people logged on simultaneously. Republicans demanded the resignation of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, who managed the product. Sebelius has had 3.5 years to launch Obamacare, and she has failed, said Senator Pat Rogers. Sebelius insisted she would stay and fix the problems. "It's tough to take these shots," she said, "but I will take them until we get this right." What the editorial said: the computer snafu was self-inflicted incompetence, said the Washington Post. Obama has claimed that the number of people who have visited the site has been overwhelming, with about 20 million visits since October 1st. Why is that so overwhelming? Google and Facebook handle billions of visitors every month. The problem is that Sebelius' department behaved as if this project were not a priority. The bugs aren't just in the software, said the Chicago Tribune. They're in the law itself. For Obamacare to work, millions of healthy young Americans must sign up to offset the cost of health care for older people and those with chronic conditions. But an analysis of 22 of the lowest-priced plans on the Illinois Exchange found a major catch: very high deductibles requiring individuals to lay out up to $4,000 and families $8,000 in medical bills before coverage kicks in. That's no bargain. If healthy young people decide to swallow a modest penalty instead of enrolling, the entire system could plunge as costs rise, insurers pull out, and markets collapse. What the columnist said: the technical problems with the website are not the whole story, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. In the 14 states that opted to run their own insurance marketplaces, including California, New York, and Kansas, the online exchanges have been running much more smoothly. About 180,000 people have so far completed applications for insurance in these states, proving that Americans want health care reform and that the law can work, once the technology piece is in place. But Obamacare is doomed if the fix-it efforts move too slowly, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The problems persist into December or beyond. If problems persist into December or beyond, Obama will have to delay the law's individual mandate because he can't fine people for not buying a product that isn't available to them. No wonder liberals are embarrassed and furious, said Chris Steyerwalt in FoxNews.com. The failure of healthcare.gov poses a major threat to their near-religious belief in the ability of technology and government to deliver a brighter, sleeker, faster, and more affordable future for healthcare. Republicans should be careful what they wish for, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. Obamacare was never the left's dream health plan, and its reliance on private insurance companies was a sop to Republicans. Liberals would prefer Medicare for all, a single-payer system with no insurance companies. Obamacare's failure wouldn't necessarily boost Republican health care proposals, which also require the government to run online insurance marketplaces. It might, however, strengthen the case for a much simpler government-run health care system. And the second main story, another try for a grand bargain. What happened? Congressional Republicans and Democrats began preparing for the opening next week of major budget negotiations that will show whether the two parties can forge a grand bargain over taxes, spending, entitlement reform, and the mandatory cuts known as the sequester. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that whether the GOP reaches a broad agreement with the Democrats, the party has learned its lesson over tactics. There will not be another government shutdown, he said. You can count on that. A Washington Post ABC News poll released this week found that 53% of Americans blamed the Republicans for the shutdown, against 29% who blamed President Obama. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, called the impact of the shutdown a wake-up call for the party. This was a political gift to the president by the Republican Party at a time he needed it most, he said. The bicameral talks on spending cuts will be led by Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, and Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington. Under terms of a deal passed last week, the conference must agree on a spending bill by December 13th, and Congress must pass it before government funding runs out on January 15th. Obama said he was willing to make concessions on entitlement reform and spending if Republicans would meet him halfway and agree to raise additional revenue by closing tax loopholes for the rich. I will look for willing partners wherever I can get important work done, he said. What the editorial said. The Republican Party has been chastened by its disastrous provocation of a government shutdown, said the Washington Post, making a budget deal more likely than ever before. And the conditions for a grand bargain do exist. The GOP must agree to relax the across-the-board sequester cuts to domestic programs agreed to as part of the 2011 debt ceiling deal. In exchange, Democrats must accept Medicare and Social Security reforms previously suggested by the president, a change in how inflation is calculated, for example, or means testing. Such a compromise could finally produce the fiscal bargain America needs. A deal can be reached only if Democrats drop the demands for new revenue, said the Wall Street Journal. Taxes already rose for all working Americans on January 1st, and Republicans will stand firm against any further increase. The president holding out for higher taxes is just as pointless as the GOP insisting that Obama defund the health care law. It will kill any deal. What the columnist said. Republicans have the upper hand in these negotiations, said Fred Barnes in the Wall Street Journal. The sequester cuts already reduced spending by $84 billion this year and will cut another $109 billion in 2014. It's true that next year's cuts take a huge bite out of Pentagon spending, which many Republicans rightly feel may degrade military readiness, but the sequester's value as a political instrument is immense. If Democrats insist on new taxes or refuse to cut entitlements, Republicans can just sit on their hands and watch spending drop. That's a bluff, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Not too long ago, Republicans considered the sequester a horror show, with House Speaker John Boehner criticizing it, its meat axe approach to spending cuts. What makes the GOP think Obama will willingly agree to cut trillions of dollars from Social Security and Medicare? Programs so popular, Republicans would never dare enact the cuts themselves. In exchange for a few billion dollars in immediate spending increases that the GOP actually wants? There's no way Obama will take this terrible, terrible deal. So, forget a grand bargain, said Robert Robb in the Phoenix, Arizona Republic. The GOP will inevitably overreach in negotiations, while the Democrats will refuse to cut entitlements without their non-starter demand for tax increases. In the Senate, Democrats might work with hawkish Republicans to relax the sequester on military spending, but that proposal will flounder in the House, where deficit hawks overwhelmingly outnumber defense hawks. Even a mini-bargain is too much to hope for in these polarized times. The more likely scenario is an impasse even more prolonged and difficult to bridge. For our controversy of the week, the GOP. Is Ted Cruz the new face of the party? Ted Cruz is the new leader of the Republican Party, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. Scoff if you like, but while most Americans have nothing but contempt for the self-serving Texas radical who spearheaded the GOP's doomed shutdown-slash-debt-ceiling strategy, Cruz is more popular than ever among the Tea Party faction. A new Pew Research Center poll finds Cruz's favorable rating among Tea Partiers at an eye-popping 74%, against only 8% unfavorable. These same fired-up conservatives dominate the Republicans' primary process. So while Cruz's chances of winning the presidency in 2016 is about as close to zero as any plausible candidate's chance could be, his odds of winning the party's presidential nomination are substantial. The GOP must decide, and decide soon, whether Cruz's angry, extremist rhetoric will define its message, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Republican hopes of seizing control of the Senate and keeping control of the House in 2014 could very well hinge on the same single significant determinant, whether Ted Cruz stops talking. The real question is whether Republicans will stop listening, said Peter Greer in CSMonitor.com. Yes, Cruz may have thrilled the Tea Partiers with his doomed crusade against Obamacare, which made him, in effect, the president of U.S. conservatives, but the portion of Republican voters who identify as Tea Partiers was down to 35% last month. And establishment Republicans loathe the guy and blame him for the severe political damage the party suffered during the futile shutdown fight. Go ask Rick Santorum, Michelle Bachmann, or Herman Cain if being the darling of the hard right is enough to secure the Republican nomination. Next time, though, said Eric Erickson in redstate.com, conservatives will not put up with another centrist chosen by the Wall Street, Washington establishment. Cruz speaks for Main Street Republicans who believe the growth of big government has actually brought America to an existential crisis, and who think we must fight as we've never fought before. In the end, the GOP's internal struggle over tone and tactics, not policy, said Jeff Schessel in NewYorker.com. On the central issues of the day, the extremists of the Tea Party are merely repeating, albeit at higher volume, the same dogmatic positions the GOP's moderates have staked out for years. Abhorrence of Obamacare, adamant disbelief in climate change, loathing of government, and unquestioned faith in tax cuts and the free market. The Tea Party is nothing but a crystallization, a highly potent concentrate of the party's belief system. But tone and tactics matter, said George Will in the Washington Post. What the Tea Party doesn't understand, and mainstream Republicans do, is that in our political system, all progress is incremental. No one wants to compromise, but the separation of powers built into our constitutional system prevents any one party or politician from gaining lasting control. To translate intentions into achievements requires patience, bargaining, and a willingness to adopt the strategy that has the best chance of success, rather than the one that provides the most dramatic and satisfying display of your convictions. For the sake of their party and the nation, it's time for the remaining adults in the GOP to explain to Cruz and his fans in the Tea Party that they have a choice to make, said Leonard Pitts in the Miami Herald. They can have purity, or they can have power. They cannot have both. It was a good week for making nice after Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, suggested the country drop its famed Death to America chant in order to improve relations with the West. We can stand up against powers with prudence rather than with slogans, said Rouhani. It was a good week for fixing Congress. After the government announced that the U.S. Capitol's iconic dome will be covered in scaffolding for 2 years to repair 1,300 cracks and other structural damage. It was a good week for having a heart. After Miami-Dade police officer Vicky Thomas decided not to arrest a penniless mother who was shoplifting groceries and bought her $100 worth of food instead. Seeing the mom's hungry kids open the bags of food was like Christmas, Thomas said. That $100 to me was worth it. It was a bad week for heartlessness. After police arrested an unemployed Ohio woman for allegedly stealing $2.87 in coins from a fountain. I'm trying to feed myself, said Deidre Romaine. Now I might go to jail. It was a bad week for running up the score. After the undefeated high school football team from Aledo, Texas, crushed the Western Hills team 91-0. I would never ask our kids not to play hard, said Aledo's coach. And it was a bad week for the illusion of anonymity. After the White House fired National Security official Jofi Joseph for his comments on an anonymous Twitter account. In the tweets, Joseph called top Obama aide Valerie Jarrett vacuous, said Huma Abedin must have been wearing beer goggles when she married Anthony Weiner, and mocked Sarah Palin and her family as white trash. In the briefing section today, the Sunni-Shiite War. Syria's civil war has devolved into a brutal sectarian conflict that could engulf the entire region. Why is Syria so pivotal? The conflict in Syria began in March 2011 as a pro-democracy movement, like other Arab Spring uprisings. But as foreign fighters have poured in on both sides, the rebellion has morphed into a sectarian civil war that other Islamic nations see as pivotal for the entire region. Syria is the only Middle Eastern country that has a majority Sunni population, but is ruled by a Shiite majority. The Assads, who took power in 1970, are Alawites, a subsect of Shia Islam that broke away in the 9th century. Together with Orthodox Shiites, Alawites make up just 13% of the population, yet they have dominated the government, business, and the country's aristocracy. Now that the regime has lost control of half of Syria, the Alawites and other Shiites fear the wrath of the Sunni majority, and they are appealing for help from Shiites abroad. The Sunni rebels have also asked fellow Sunnis for aid, arms, and fighters. Are the two sects radically different? No more so than Catholicism and Protestantism. Both Sunnis and Shiites follow the five pillars of Islam, revering Allah as the only God and Muhammad as his prophet, praying five times a day, fasting during Ramadan, giving to charity, and making a pilgrimage to Mecca. The split occurred in the religion's infancy. When Muhammad died in 632, his followers argued over whether he should be succeeded by one of his fathers-in-law, Abu Bakr, or by one of his sons-in-law, Ali, Abu Bakr I, and became the first caliph. Ali, whose followers say Muhammad chose him as heir, briefly ruled as the fourth caliph, but was assassinated in 661, and his son Hussein was killed fighting for the caliphate in 680. Why did that split last? It gave both groups their names, a strong sense of identity, and a different style of worship. Shiite, or Shia, comes from Shi'at Ali, meaning the followers of Ali, while Sunni means those who adhere to the Sunnah, or sayings of the Prophet. In Shiite eyes, the defeat of Hussein bequeathed them a legacy of oppression and exclusion. They place great emphasis on identifying and venerating Muhammad's descendants as Allah's representatives on earth, and that leads them to give the clergy a central role in political life. Shiites are religiously obliged to follow the teachings of their clerics, imams, and ayatollahs. Sunnis, by contrast, have no formally organized clerical hierarchy, but see Islam as accessible to anyone who studies devoutly. That belief allows for the rise of extremist fringe groups like Al-Qaeda. Have the two always fought? No. For most of the 20th century, rulers in the Muslim world kept religion and politics largely separate. An exception was the Saud dynasty in Saudi Arabia, which promoted Wahhabism, a puritanical strain of Sunni Islam. The turning point was the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the emergence of a Shiite theocracy. Since then, in political conflicts across the Muslim world, Iran has served as a sponsor to embattled Shiite minorities. Iran reached out to Lebanese Shiites, for example, creating and funding Hezbollah, its strongest militant proxy. Is Iran sending fighters to Syria? Indirectly, yes. The foreign influx to Syria started on the Sunni side. Rebels, frustrated that Western countries wouldn't send them weapons, turned to jihadists for help, including al-Qaeda sympathizers from across the region, especially Iraq. This spring, Hezbollah jumped into the conflict on the side of the regime, apparently on the direct orders of Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. "This battle is ours," Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah said in May. "There are now up to 4,000 skilled Hezbollah fighters trained by Iran battling rebel groups in Syria. The Sunni rebels have a new backer of their own. The Saudis are funding a militant leader in Syria with the aim of uniting the disparate Islamist militias under the banner of the Salafists, Sunni hardliners." What does this mean for the region? Big trouble. In a broad sense, Saudi Arabia and Iran are competing for influence over the entire Middle East and are willing to fuel civil wars in pursuit of their goals. Many Sunni-ruled nations have large restive Shiite populations, particularly Bahrain, Yemen, and Kuwait. Sunni rulers fear that these populations could become radicalized by the Syrian conflict and stage uprisings of their own. King Abdullah of Jordan, a Sunni, has warned of the danger of a Shiite crescent spreading across the Middle East. "The fires of Syria will blaze for some time to come," said Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador to several countries in the region. "Like a major forest fire, the most we can do is hope to contain it." Moving on to our best columns from the U.S., the first comes from Robert Samuelson at the Washington Post. "Entitlements aren't sacred." "Let's drop the whole notion of entitlement," said Robert Samuelson. This vague term now covers more than a dozen federal aid programs, including Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, child nutrition, and veterans compensation, which together consume a stunning 63% of the federal budget. The U.S. has $17 trillion in debt primarily because of these popular aid programs cost more than Americans are willing to be taxed. Hypocritically, voters hate excessive spending and deficits, but scream if any political leader even suggests a cut to their own entitlements. The word implies that these benefits programs are somehow untouchable. But the government can and must make changes in these programs. Draconian cuts aren't needed, but even modest shifts in eligibility requirements and benefit levels for Social Security and Medicare alone would produce huge savings, tens of billions per year. The changes could be phased in over years to make them more palatable. So let's get rid of the notion of entitlement. Programs shouldn't be shielded from constructive criticism and change just because they're hiding behind an obsolete label. Our second column, "Peddling Lies About Obamacare," is by Eric Stern from Salon.com. In a typical piece of partisan propaganda, Fox News recently aired three supposed horror stories from people already adversely affected by Obamacare, said Eric Stern. "These are the stories that the media refuses to cover," said host Sean Hannity gravely intoned. He then interviewed three couples who claimed to be victims of the Affordable Care Act. To see if their stories were true, I tracked the guests down. The first couple had told Hannity that Obamacare was hurting the family construction business and forcing them to limit the hours of employees. But they admitted to me that their business employs only 4 people. Obamacare has no impact on businesses with fewer than 50 employees, so their horror story was just a lie. The next 2 couples claimed that their insurance policies were being terminated and that their rates were going way up. But neither couple had even tried to shop on the exchange, and when I plugged in their data, I easily found them insurance that would actually cost about 60% less than their current policies. Will Obamacare actually provide quality health care at affordable prices? We don't know that yet. But beware of fake evidence being peddled by those with blatantly partisan agendas. In our third column, from Robert N. Proctor at Los Angeles Times, "The Unhappy Birthday of the Cigarette." This month marks the 100th anniversary of the modern cigarette, said Robert N. Proctor. But don't expect much in the way of fanfare. It was in October 1913 that Camel Cigarettes debuted in the U.S., introducing a new tobacco blend that was both mild enough to be inhaled and sweet from sugars added to the mix. Sold in cleverly packaged boxes of 20, Camels proved to be wildly popular, with 425 million cigarettes sold in 1914, and 6.5 billion 2 years later. At its peak in 1952, Camel sold a staggering 105 billion cigarettes. Today, we know that smoking causes cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and other fatal illnesses. The 4 trillion Camels sold over the last century have killed about 4 million people. That's why decades of steady decline have cut cigarette sales, including Camels, by half. Nonetheless, R.J. Reynolds and its parent company, Altria, are celebrating Camel's birthday with an ad campaign in Mexico and Europe, where sales remain robust. But here, any self-congratulation would seem in poor taste. That's because Camel's success has been literally breathtaking, caravaning millions into that sleep from which we never awake. Our last word article this week was written by comedian Billy Crystal. It's titled, "At Home on the Range." "I was a cowboy in another life," said Billy Crystal, "and it helped me play one in the movies." Training to be a cowboy for city slickers brought about a bizarre case of déjà vu. In 1975, my wife, Janice, and I had made our first trip to California. We knew that at some point we might move there, so it was sort of a scouting trip. One day while driving through Joshua Tree National Monument, I pulled over because I was having a strange anxiety attack. The western landscape suddenly looked very familiar. I had the strongest feeling that I had been there before. Specifically, the feeling that I'd once been a cowboy and had ridden the same territory. Not in a rental car, but on horseback. "It's not a pleasant feeling," I said to Janice. "I know this place." "Okay, stop muttering bull blank blank. This is exactly how it happened. It threw me for a few days because, let's be honest, there weren't many Jewish cowboys. Growing up, you never saw Hopalong Chastity. So 15 years later, When we were writing the script and creating the river chase where Mitch ropes Norman the calf, who was swept away in the rapids, Lowell Gans, the writer, asked, "Can you do that?" "Yeah, I can do that," I answered. I don't know why I said that. I hadn't been on a horse since I was 9 years old. When we started training on horseback, I took to it very quickly. One day we were working on roping a steer from a galloping horse, the first step in learning how to do it for the river sequence, and sure enough, I chased the sprinting steer, holding the reins in one hand and twirling my lariat like a rodeo boys do in the other. When the steer was in range, I threw the rope, and damn if it didn't go right around the steer's neck. I pulled the horse up and jumped off and tied the steer up. The three slickers had to be unlikely cowboys, everyday men who are thrust into a tough situation. Bruno Kirby would play Ed, a pudgy sporting goods salesman, and Rick Moranis was set to play Phil, the introverted henpecked supermarket manager. The role of Curly, the old cowpoke who would lead the motley crew, was the plum role in the picture. Jack Palance was our only choice. The first movie I had ever seen was Shane, where Jack played Wilson, the bad guy who gets it in the end. I never forgot how scary he was. Ron Underwood, our terrific director, set up a meeting with the man himself at the bar at the Hotel Bel Air. We arrived early, and when Jack walked in, we were both a little starstruck at first. His large head was the perfect finish to his long, athletic body. He had a certain natural spookiness to him, and as we talked, I could see that he loved to play on it. He was very well read, smart, and in a word, classy. He loved the script and wanted to do it, but he had a scheduling conflict with another film and wasn't sure it was going to work out. We were crushed, and since shooting was about to begin, we needed a backup. With a 24-hour window facing us, we secretly reached out to another icon, Charles Bronson. His agent assured us that he would read the script right away. The thought of Bronson in this role was in its own way very appealing. He was an intense actor, scary, of course, and would make a tough and hilarious Curly. The next day I was told to be at my office at a certain time, as Mr. Bronson would be calling me. I sat by the phone, nervous about talking to him. The phone rang. "Hello," I said cheerfully. "Blank you," he replied. I waited for the punchline. There wasn't one. "Blank you. I'm dead on page 64. How dare you send this to me?" I wasn't sure if he was joking or not. "You have a lot of nerve," he went on. "I don't die in my films." I was about to remind him that he died in The Magnificent Seven, but before I could, he said it again. "Blank you. Mr. Bronson, I'm sorry you feel that this way. It's a great part." "No, it's not. I'm dead on page 60 blanking 4. And he hung up. I sat there, stunned. And then the phone rang, and it was Jack's agent saying he'd blown off the other film because he wanted to do this one. And we were home safe. We went into full rehearsal, and then tragedy struck Rick Moranis. His wife had been diagnosed with a serious illness, and he had to leave the film. Danny Stern came on to play Phil, and the three of us made perfect sense together. Bruno was the unlikely pudgy tough guy, and Danny the tall and timid Phil. He arrived the day before shooting started and never had time to train on his horse. Dean Semler was our director of photography. He'd won an Oscar for Dances with Wolves, but his first love was comedy. Many of the scenes we had to film were very challenging, Most shots had a few hundred cows in them, and our real heroes were the cowboy wranglers, who kept the cows in frame. Our stunt coordinator, Mickey Gilbert, had been Robert Redford's stuntman in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And he designed every shot with Ron Underwood to make the action look real and, at times, dangerous. And it didn't just look dangerous. For the river crossing, Danny, Bruno, and I actually brought 450 head of cattle down a muddy hillside and into and across the swiftly moving river. Huge fire hoses and giant fans simulated a rainstorm and pelted us with water from above. Nets had been set up down river from bank to bank to catch any animals or actors that might get pulled away by the current. In the scene, Norman the calf would get swept away from the herd, and I would ride along the riverbank and heroically rope him, only to take a fall into the surging river myself, and then go after him when he got caught in the swirling rapids. My stuntman, Brian Burrows, did the majority of the whitewater rapids work. But I got in there as well. The water was 52 degrees, and I wore a wetsuit under my clothes. Mickey kept telling me to pee in my wetsuit when I got cold. Remember, pee is 92 degrees. After we'd shot for 5 weeks, Jack joined us for 2 weeks. We were a well-oiled machine by the time the Big Cat, as we called him, arrived. The crew was as excited as I was about his arrival. When Jack, dressed all in black, arrived on the set, everyone applauded. Jack's first shot was to confront a ranch hand who was making lewd remarks to Helen Slater's character. He would rope the dude around the neck and then enter the corral and confront him and me, which would start our relationship. Ron, who is a gentle, sweet man, easily mistaken for a puppeteer, softly explained to Jack what he wanted. Then you come through the gate and see Billy and give him a glare. Jack pounced. What the blank does that mean, give him a glare? I don't glare. I'm a blanking actor. Tell me what I'm thinking, not what I'm doing. Things had been going swimmingly, and now the Big Cat apparently had a thorn in his paw. I quieted Jack down, and Ron apologized to Jack as best he could. Let's just do this, Jack yelled. Action! Jack got off his horse, walked through the gate, and gave me a glare like a laser beam that went through my head and burned a hole in the fence behind me. Cut! Print! Said Ron. It was a lesson to us all. Jack knew what he was doing. He knew who he was, and he needed to be talked to in a certain way. After that day, Jack and I were alone for 10 days shooting all of our scenes together, including the one where we birthed Norman, our little calf. That scene is one of the most talked about in the film. I'm asked all the time what it was like to birth a calf, because it looks so real. Our special effects crew created the rear section of a cow. It was a perfect anatomical replica, complete with lungs that would breathe as a cow in distress would. They covered a few days old runt calf in realistic bloody jelly and folded the little guy up. And I pulled him out of the faux birth canal. He must have been thinking, didn't I just get out of here? It was a lovely moment between Jack and me. For a crusty, sometimes intimidating man, Jack was actually a very sensitive guy. He understood how to act on film better than anyone I had worked with up to that point. He knew how to hold the frame. More than anything, he knew that the size of his head was a powerful instrument. Jack found the right way to hold his big head, and Dean Semler understood exactly how to light him. He was also a poignant figure to me. Curly's was meant to be the last of the cowboys, and Jack, at this stage of his life and career, embodied that idea of a dying breed. He had trouble remembering his lines at times. I would watch him rehearsing his words with his wife, and I would walk over and say I was having trouble with the scene, and would he mind going over it with me? He labored some days to get his 70-year-old body onto his horse for all the hours we had to be in the saddle. He never complained. On the night we finished shooting Jack's work in the film, I asked him, "Why did you go so crazy that day? Why did you yell at Ron like that and carry on?" He looked at me and simply said in that gravelly voice, "It was my first day. I always get nervous on the first day." "How many movies have you made?" I asked. "Counting the stuff I did in Europe, about 300. "And you still get nervous?" I asked incredulously. "Only on the first day," he replied. The Golden Globes honored us with several nominations, including Best Comedy, Best Supporting Actor for Jack, and Best Actor in a Comedy for me. We were sitting together when Jack won. I was elated. This meant he had a real shot at the Oscar. He made a short speech and came back to the table. "Jack, you're supposed to go to the press room," I told him. "No way. I'm going to be here when you win." I was very moved, but then shortly thereafter I lost. Instantly, Jack got up to leave. "Where are you going?" I asked him. "The press room. You lost." This was excerpted from "Still Fooling 'Em, Where Have I Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys" by Billy Crystal, published in September 2013. On the Health and Science page, a simplified version of human evolution. An almost intact 1.8 million-year-old skull found in the Republic of Georgia offers stunning evidence that human evolution may have been much simpler than previously thought, with a single Homo species spreading through Africa before migrating to Eurasia. Skull 5, as it is known, is the oldest complete skull of an early adult Homo ever found, and its combination of attributes, a long face, large teeth, and tiny brain case, has come as a revelation. Had the brain case and the face of Skull 5 been found as separate fossils at different sites in Africa, they might have been attributed to different species. University of Zurich paleoanthropologist Christopher Zollicoffer tells the New York Times, "Remnants of four other hominids found at the same site also had variations as great as those anthropologists have used to distinguish among entirely different Homo species. Since we see a similar pattern and range of variation in the African fossil record," says Zollicoffer, "it is sensible to assume that there was a single Homo species at that time in Africa. That would mean that specimens previously identified as Homo ergaster, Homo rudolfensis, and Homo habilis are all actually part of a single early Homo species that evolved into modern humans." Coexistence in the Stone Age. Many archaeologists have long thought that the spread of farming from the Near East spelled a quick end for Central Europe's indigenous hunter-gatherers. But a new DNA study of a cache of ancient skeletons shows that farmers and hunters actually coexisted side by side for some 2,000 years without interbreeding. Researchers analyze the mitochondrial DNA of bone fragments found in a German cave that had been used as a burial site during two periods, one ending about 10,000 years ago and another about 5,000 years ago, or about 2,000 years after farming spread to the region. They found that of the 20 individuals dated to the agricultural era, 12 were of hunter-gatherer lineage. Chemical analysis confirmed that while the farmers ate domesticated animals, the hunter-gatherers from the same age subsisted largely on freshwater fish. Rather than being immediately outcompeted, driven away, or subsumed into the farmers' population, hunter-gatherers apparently lived alongside farmers for millennia and even buried their dead in the same cave, but never interbred with them. I think it's very unlikely they did not know of each other or trade, archaeologist Ruth Bolongino tells LifeScience.com. But for some reason, they stayed amongst themselves. And from our talking points, online bullying, charging kids with felonies. When a 12-year-old is tormented to death, said Keith Ablow in FoxNews.com, it should be considered a serious crime, no matter who does the tormenting. Finally, law enforcement agencies seem to be taking psychological assault as seriously as physical assault. Polk County, Florida officials have brought felony charges against two girls in connection with the September suicide of 7th grader Rebecca Sedwick. Police say Guadalupe Shaw, 14, and Caitlin Roman, 12, taunted Rebecca online and face-to-face for a year, telling her to drink bleach and die until one day after changing her online username to That Dead Girl, Rebecca threw herself off a cement plant in Lakeland, Florida. In a stunning demonstration of heartlessness, Shaw later allegedly posted a taunting confession on Facebook that read, "Yes, I know I bullied Rebecca and she killed herself, but I don't give a blank." Someone that sick needs enforced psychiatric care, even if she is 14. Charging middle schoolers with a felony may be viscerally satisfying, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. But it's also a clear overreaction. Yes, Shaw's apparent lack of remorse for allegedly bullying Rebecca to death is horrifying. But anti-stalking laws are usually reserved for physical harassment. The First Amendment protects even vile and offensive statements meant to wound. Shaw and Roman should be punished, but not by a felony conviction. It's hard to feel compassion for girls who drove an apparently troubled classmate over the edge, said Emily Bazelon in Slate.com. But vicious online speech is sadly quite common, and singling out two kids for criminal charges isn't the answer. Instead, why aren't we holding the adults around them, their parents, responsible? Good question, said Mark O'Mara in CNN.com. If a teen kills someone while recklessly using the family car, the parents can be legally responsible. Why should using a computer or cell phone provided by the parent be any different? In the internet era, parents should no longer be allowed to plead ignorance. They need to understand that the technology they give to their children can be used to break the law and inflict harm. Suicide is the nation's third leading cause of teenage deaths, and bullying plays a direct role in that terrible toll. Before we lose another child, laws should be passed to hold parents responsible if their kids use online tools as weapons. Rape. Should women avoid getting drunk? In one awful high-profile case after another, said Emily Yoff in Slate.com, a young woman goes to a party, gets drunk, and ends up being raped. It happened at the U.S. Naval Academy in 2012. Months later, at a gathering of high school football players in Steubenville, Ohio, and now in Maryville, Missouri, where a special prosecutor will investigate the alleged rape of a 14-year-old. Well, young women, here's one simple way to prevent rape. Stop getting wasted. About 80% of college sexual assaults involve alcohol, and the rise of female binge drinking has made campuses a rich environment for sexual predators who lurk like lions at a watering hole. Let's be totally clear. Young men are the ones committing the crimes, and they should be prosecuted. But we also need to warn young women and girls that when they get blind drunk, terrible things can be done to them. Is telling women to stop being so drunk really the best advice you can give? Said Alexander Abad Santos in TheAtlantic.com. Yes, alcohol often plays its part in rape, but every single rape involves a rapist. We should be loudly telling young men not to force sex on women ever, whether they're drunk or sober, rather than lecturing women on how to behave so as to reduce their chance of being sexually assaulted. In our society's rape culture, blaming the victim is nothing new, said Katie McDonough in Salon.com. For years, women have been threatened with punishment if they make certain bad choices, such as wearing a short skirt, staying out late, and now, drinking too much. The list of reasons that Americans believe women deserve rape is long. Look, we shouldn't live in a world where getting drunk is an invitation to rape, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. But we do. In the longer term, we can fight this epidemic through education, by stigmatizing the perpetrators, and by looking after friends or strangers who've had too much to drink. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.